You're listening to The Perth Property Show, Australia's only weekly property podcast by West Australian experts for West Australian listeners. Catch your latest episode every Monday at 7 a.m.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to The Perth Property Show. My name's Trent Fleskins, your host as always. And I'm very excited to say that we've got another heavyweight advocate in the room today to discuss advocacy, policy, fix some of these supplier problems if we can. It's Emily Young, Interim Executive Director of the Property Council Australia WA branch. Emily, thanks for coming in, mate.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Now, you've been in this room before supporting Sandra Brewer when she was Executive Director, and we were on a bit of a rampage last year with our advocacy position, and a lot got done. I was very proud about the industry's outcomes when it came to advocating for policy change to try and get ahead of what's going on right now, but we're not done. There's still a lot of work to be done, and it comes down to really the PCA, the UDIA, REWA, these big advocacy groups to come together with the same message, be on the same page, and really keep advocating to the government on how we believe this problem, this critical supplier problem we've got in WA that doesn't seem to be going away for years to come, can eventually be solved. And you're at the head of this. It's your job to try and cut through to government these messages that we think are the great ideas. And the Property Council has just come out with their pre-election roadmap, I guess you'd call it. And I thought it would be a good idea to get you in today to have a discussion about what those key principles are, those key advocacy points. Is that what we're going to chat about today?
Yeah, I think that that's a really good starting point. And you raise some really excellent points already, Trent. The property market is such a critical piece in our overall state's economic engine. And so it is really important when we're having conversations with government across the spectrum of advocates that represent this great industry, that we are talking and singing from a similar song sheet. I do also think that the issues that we're facing are pretty multifaceted at the moment. It's not simply a case of having one solution or one golden bullet that's going to be able to fix or turn around the Titanic that is housing supply. But I do think that we do have some really good opportunities to have thoughtful conversations with all sides of government as we head towards the election in 2025.
I think in early 2023, it was Megan Adair who said publicly that it's death by a thousand cuts in the industry in terms of trying to solve these solutions. So if you reverse that in the same manner, there really is a thousand different ways that we need to be advocating to the government on how things can get fixed. It's not just, can we get more people in to build? Can we build cheaper? It's taxes. It's time frames with regards to policies. It's financing barriers for apartment developers. It's infrastructure costs and timing in terms of house and land as well. There are so many different factors getting in the way right now that we have pragmatic conversations about all the time and how we solve these problems. But I guess it's going to take a monumental effort by a number of people at an advocacy level, but also government level to try and chip away at these issues. And look, we have been chipping away, haven't we?
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen some really fantastic reforms in recent years, a lot of which came into effect on the 1st of March this year. We're eagerly anticipating how the reforms to the development assessment panels will impact the efficiency of planning decision making. The new state significant development pathway is also a really fantastic initiative of government, and we're excited to see how the shortened timeframes or the 120-day assessment timelines will help support greater efficiency in that space. Also, we know that the WAPC are undertaking a process of review. Equally, I've had lots of really good conversations with Development WA in recent weeks around looking at how that organisation functions to best deliver outcomes for WA too. So there's been some really, really positive change, and we have a planning minister who is really proactive and really open to bold and innovative solutions. And I think that that's an exciting place for us to be in right now.
You talk about these organisations, and I think it's important to mention because it is going to take a team effort here. I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago with Richard Pappas, and for me, I think I called it Team WA. Everyone needs to get on the same page, whether it's the advocates, the developers, the local government, the state government organisations, the non-government organisations, to all start peering their head out of the silo and start working as a team about moving in the one direction and still recognising the important priorities that each have, but finding common ground and moving forward. A lot of this gets solved by improving our culture.
Yeah, and I think that there is really, for the first time, a true sense of bipartisanship when it comes to housing. There's a recognition across the political spectrum and across the advocacy world that housing and our ability to deliver more housing over the next couple of years is going to be quite critical to our economic productivity and our future success. So that puts us in a really good position to be having robust, thoughtful conversations around what we can do next as we head towards the state election to really drive some really strong housing outcomes for WA.
It is bipartisan. It has to be, because whether you're Labor or you're Liberal or you're Greens, most of us have or will have kids. And it's really about that future of that next generation, for which it's becoming very obvious that this housing supply is going to continue to push them out of the market and minimize the opportunities they have compared to the opportunities we had, or our parents, for example. It's just getting harder and harder to live that life that our parents, our grandparents tried to build for us.
There's certainly a shift that we're seeing across the country and here in WA as well, where the idea that we can preserve our suburbs in amber like the mosquito in Jurassic Park and make sure that they never change is dropping away. We are more broadly accepting that our communities are changing, that the composition and the diversity of housing that we see in our communities needs to change. And a lot of that comes from that place that you spoke to exactly just there, Trent, is that we want our friends and our older relatives and our children to be able to move into a housing option in the suburbs that they have grown up in the suburbs where their communities are and in the suburbs that they love. And 900 square meter lots everywhere in a suburb isn't going to provide that opportunity. So it's about really looking at how do we age in place? How do we create communities for our next generation? But then also how do we preserve that really strong community feeling that we've already created in some of our established suburbs? Because that's equally as important.
I call it housing mobility. And I think, like most things, variety is the spice of life. And you can definitely see those suburbs that are pushing ahead. Perfect example in the western suburbs, where you've got no capacity issues in terms of affordability for those people living there. They're there because they can be there. But the suburbs that are really pushed ahead, let's think about Cottesloe, are ones that have got that housing variety. There's choice of everything. There's apartments that are coming up on the ocean. There's smaller townhouses. There's older flats. There's the big mansion. There's your terrace houses as well. And because of that variety and the amenity provided, the mixed-use business options, the small wine bars, those things that are around the area, the amenity has pushed values in Cottesloe far beyond, for example, let's call it Dalkeith. Dalkeith, we spoke to Cameron Kane about last week, is an example of a suburb that historically was the millionaire's playgrounds, is now languishing a little bit behind simply because it has no diversity in stock. And there's no ability in that suburb really for locals to downsize or for the kids to afford to buy their first home, because everything is a $3 million mansion plus. I agree with you, being able to create a platform that has more accessible, more easily approvable, less taxed housing options that aren't just that quarter acre 4x2 is definitely the solution to creating more vibrant communities where people just enjoy living and the grandkid can live in the same street as the grandma.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we see the broader economic benefits all the time. Even when you look at the Civic Heart Project, which is due to complete this year, the level of retail activation that we're already seeing around Men Street as a result of that future population is really exciting. And the station is another great example, which is attached to the project, has brought a whole new pub to that community. And that's benefited not just that pub, but also the Windsor across the road.
So everyone wins.
That's exactly right. It's bringing population and amenity into suburbs is a win-win. And we just need to be thinking about it in a way where we're really looking at where are the opportunities for us to say yes to the future without being scared of it.
So is this the YIMBY campaign that you're about to start up?
So we've got two really exciting pieces of work in market at the moment. The first one is our election platform, which we're going to talk about today. But the other one is a piece of work that hasn't yet come out to market that we're really excited to be launching on the 24th of April. And that's our YIMBY research, Yes in My Backyard. We're delivering that with the APP group. And it really is going to be an opportunity to take some deep insights into how do we change the conversation around housing diversity in Western Australia, and also take an approach which is focused on housing abundance first. And so we're launching that event at a great lunch, and I'd encourage everyone to get along to that. If you'd like some information on how to buy tickets, please reach out to me.
So I guess it's pretty self-explanatory, Yes in My Backyard. But what are the arguments? If we can put it out on the table today, everyone knows why our NIMBY is a NIMBY, but why should we be a YIMBY?
Yeah, because we really want to be able to be creating vibrant, sustainable communities close to existing infrastructure. We did a piece of research last year around transit-oriented developments, and we looked at where there were greater opportunities for greater density around some of our train stations and activity centres. But what we really know is that there are lots of areas through Perth where we have the existing infrastructure, we have the schools set up, we have the parks set up, We have everything that's needed to help grow those communities, but they're very low density. So what we do need to think about is how can we bring more vibrancy, greater housing diversity to those communities and really be driving some strong outcomes. But in those communities, we do also find that there can be a bit of resistance because of fear and a bit of a fear of the unknown.
Change, right? People that's don't right. like change, especially the older generations who, to be frank, are more characterized in that NIMBY space.
Yeah, and we do see from time to time arguments being used that really aren't based in fact to try and push back against housing developments.
Amenity, right? Everyone calls it, oh, my amenity is going to be down. But what I think, if we're really honest about it, most people who have fear about their amenity being reduced are actually just fearing that the value of their house is going to go down. The irony is that when you have, just as we characterized before, these vibrant melting pot communities, you've actually got suburbs here that we're seeing that are increasing in value far quicker than the suburbs that are very homogenous.
Yeah, that's right. Even when you look at Subiaco and the revival that's had off the back of one Subiaco. The other thing that's really important to remember is we hear regularly conversations around the impact of apartment projects on tree canopy in suburbs, for example, and also on traffic. But both of those arguments, when you look at them really more deeply, the more communities that we're putting into suburbs that don't have public transport opportunities, that don't have the ability to have a high frequency service because they are smaller, the more people we're forcing onto our roads. And that's what really does generate traffic closer to the CBD.
Think about the freeway. Kwinana Freeway, I've never had a straight run. And I'm thinking the thousands of people listening to this will be nodding their head going, yeah, I can't remember the last time I just did 100 Ks an hour down Kwinana Freeway without stopping at Armidale Road or Leach Highway or Thomas Road. Why? Because of these land subdivisions that are further down, clogging it up along the way.
That's right. And those land subdivisions have a definite place in our market. But when we talk about where are the opportunities that are created by introducing more apartment living into WA, one of the things that we do see is that when you can bring two large sites together and build 300 homes on two large sites, instead of having to create 300 homes across 450 square meter blocks in a suburb that doesn't currently exist, our environmental outcomes are better, our social outcomes are better, and we're able to drive some really strong amenity outcomes as well.
Well, think about creating 300 homes in a land estate. And I understand we need balance because we simply need supply, right?
Right.
But 300 homes would take 20 hectares to develop on. How many trees do you reckon we're cutting down for that compared to maybe, let's say, a handful of trees for 300 homes in an apartment building? Perfect example of how that YIMBY campaign makes sense. It strips away the NIMBY argument on the environment, for example, very quickly.
Yeah, that's right. And so it's really about not taking away from the legitimate fears that people have, because they are legitimate fears. But what we really want to do is just change the conversation and be saying to people like, yes, we understand why you're concerned about that, but here's some real evidence-based thinking that says to you, there's another way we can be thinking about this. Mm. And this is really about how can we be driving some better social outcomes for everybody.
Exactly. Well, good luck with the campaign. I'm a massive YIMBY, massive fan of this. I believe that any time you had an apartment building that brought some activation to the ground floor in your local area, that's a wine bar you can go to on Thursday or Friday night. That's a gym or a coffee shop that's within walking distance, otherwise might not have been there. Suddenly, your walk score in your life is that much higher. You don't have to get in the car. You're in the place to be rather than having to drive to the place to be.
And it really feeds into that strategic goal that government keep talking about, which is our walkable neighbourhoods and our livable neighbourhoods. And so if we can create more amenity within our pre-existing catchments where we do have the infrastructure capability already in place, it really is a win-win for Western Australia.
Well, let's segue that idea about how we help getting apartments into Perth into one of the ideas that PCA have that I think is an absolute winner that the government I know is listening to every week needs to listen very clearly to right now. What's the first one? It's about financing.
Yeah, so one of the challenges we know with infill development, particularly for apartment projects, is that the timelines on apartment projects and the way that they're financed create some challenges.
Well, we just saw that having a chat with Richard 2 weeks ago as Managing Director of Celsius Property Group. It's going to be a 10-year process from when he first bought the first block to when he is going to be, hopefully, titling that apartment building in North Perth. 10 years, imagine the interest payments.
Yeah, exactly right. So what are the challenges there? One of the challenges that really exists is that the way that apartment projects are financed at the moment, the developer is required to meet a pre-sales target before they can commence construction. And that's around the lending.
So an example might be, if the debt piece will be $100 million to build this apartment building, maybe the bank right now, let's call it CBA or Westpac, are going to ask for pre-sales of $80 million worth of apartments before they'll let you start. That's a lot of apartments.
Yeah, it is a lot of apartments. And the challenge with that is that regularly the costing and how much it's going to cost to build the project, all the feasibility, is at the point of ideating the project. Mm. So if it then takes an additional 12 months or 18 months or 2 years
look
to achieve
that
pre-sale, the escalations become really problematic. So what we'd like to do is encourage an environment where government could act as the guarantor, a bit like mum and dad do in the house and land package for developers, to then underwrite the pre-sales in their finance arrangements.
So they don't need pre-sales, they can get straight to site.
Straight to site. And the idea here is that then the developer would be able to commence construction straight away. They'd be able to lock in the builder, lock in some of those prices, and really get projects moving in a really fast way. That doesn't actually require government to outlay any of the finance.
All of those, no hand in the pocket.
That's right. All of the due diligence would still sit with the banks. But what it would mean is that when the projects were getting to the point where you could see a tangible finish line, you could start selling product at a market rate. So you could factor in any of those additional cost escalations that might have occurred throughout the project. But you're also selling into the market, so you're not having to crystal ball the price. So setting it at a price that off the plan regularly looks at a little bit above market, because you're anticipating that there'll be some price growth over the life cycle of the project. If you can pull that back and really be selling at a market rate, we can be delivering more affordable stock to market
quicker.
We can be delivering it quickly, and we can be locking in those builders, which we know has been a challenge over the last couple of years.
Also, when you think about the trepidation buyers have right now, why aren't they buying apartments off the plan right now?
Well, because they're worried the projects aren't going to start.
Exactly. So if we
can see it starting, cranes in the ground. Western Australians love to see cranes in the ground. And that's why we were really pleased with the state government's decision to introduce the stamp duty concession for under construction. But this is just another thing that we can do to really supercharge the scale of delivery over the next period of time.
I'm going to be clear here. We're not giving developers money.
No.
All we're doing is underwriting that project. The government needs to happen anyway to solve this problem. The developers still taking their risk, the bank's still taking their risk, we're just bringing the project forward. I promise you, in 2019, 20, 21, that there are a number of projects that were about to start that didn't start because they were sitting there waiting for pre-sales, and the cost escalation along that time sent the project broke. And now we're still waiting 4 or 5 years later for that project to start, and it's even further away from being able to start because of costs, right? If we could have started that project the day it got all its working drawings ready, those projects would have started and they would have come out the ground.
Yeah, that's right. We did a piece of work going back a couple of years now where we looked at the number of projects that had gone on hold because of that exact issue, and we estimated around 20,000 apartments had gone on hold at the time.
That solves our problem.
It's a big gap in the market. I think it is really important for us to look at these innovative solutions, and we'll be talking with the Treasurer's Office and also the opposition about this idea as we head towards the election.
Well, I would say this is a big piece. I'm excited to see what your next points are, but if there was one point, this one would be one that Treasurer Saffiotti needs to look at seriously. Doesn't cost her a cent. Put some money aside in a term deposit. Underwrite these projects, because if it's not going to be the developers, I wonder if it will be the government. And what's the worst case that happens here? Let's say a project does fall over. I don't expect it would, given you've just de-risked a massive part of that project. It's a half-built apartment project you're going to finish off, and you can turn into social housing anyway. It's a win-win for the government. How can they lose here?
It's definitely a good idea to explore, if I do say so myself.
Yes. All right, Em, what's next?
Yeah, look, I think the other thing that we really would like government to think about is some new institutionally owned residential product that's coming through to market. So student accommodation and build to rent are two asset classes that can really provide a lot of housing to market quickly.
We've seen a bit of it start to come on.
A little bit, but with build to rent in particular, there are still some pretty significant tax challenges. The state government have already gone to reduce the land tax requirement down by 50%, which was a really great initiative.
Is that enough?
What we would say is that at the time it certainly was, but what we've seen subsequently is every other jurisdiction in Australia has now moved to introduce the same concession for build to rent. So for WA, being not one of the principal markets for investment, particularly from foreign capital, which tends to play a little bit in this space. What we'd really like to see is the opportunity for a 10-year 100% land tax concession for build-to-rent projects. This would really supercharge the delivery of rental stock into the market, which we know is direly stressed at the moment.
It's even more critical than our sales market.
Exactly
right.
Which
is hard to fathom, right?
Exactly right. And these are the ultimate shovel-ready projects. What we've also said in the context of this ask is that for the regions, there may be an opportunity to extend that out beyond 10 years to maybe a 20-year land tax concession.
Or perpetuity.
That's right. Really just to make sure that we're stimulating construction in the regions as well as in Perth. But this is one idea that we really see could be affected pretty quickly. At the moment, we're not seeing a huge amount of projects come online. There are a few, but it's not money lost if the projects aren't going to go ahead. Mm. So if we can increase the amount of projects, it is a short-term reduction in land tax for government's earnings, but the outcome of that is actually a really robust rental market in WA.
So to explain why we need that, this institutional owner of, let's say, a build-to-rent, they're essentially building 300 apartments that they're going to rent out forever.
Yes.
And the problem with that, which is why it's institutional owners, developers that normally do this, is because even if you did a good project, it would still be fairly low yield. We're not talking a 10% yield on these things. You need a pension fund, a superannuation fund, who's happy with your 3, 4, 5% yield to actually put the money up here and go, yeah, this is worth it to me. Taking the land tax portion away helps push the needle that little bit further to get this project to a threshold that they can press go on. Is that the point?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the reality is that our tax systems never envisaged a scenario where we would institutionalize residential accommodation. Mm. So this is really just about providing a correction in our tax system to be able to bring a really impactful, purpose, customer-led product into market. The really great thing about build to rent, which I think it's not an asset class that's particularly well known in WA yet, despite us being the first state in Australia to have a build to rent asset.
Sentinel.
But it is a really great product because it allows for greater choice for consumers. It provides for pet friendly accommodation. It provides for a level of service on site. It really provides the ability for people to transition in a single apartment community throughout their life. So I've been told this great story about the Subiaco project, where they had a young woman who moved into the building. After her first year, she met her partner. They decided they needed a little bit more space. They moved into one of the two bedders. They've subsequently started a family and they're now living in one of the three bedders. And she had the ability to transition throughout that building quite easily because it is that institutionally run rental product. And the requirement for institutionally run rental product is that it needs to run with occupancy, right? Mm. So the whole purpose is about keeping your customer happy. It's not about how do you get the maximum amount of money out of everyone. It's how do we make sure that we're full with happy customers.
When you think about land tax, the only positive you can argue with land tax is that it disincentivizes people collecting too many homes, collecting more homes than they need. There's a tax on excess. But you're right, it doesn't envisage us actually wanting to incentivize someone sponsoring 300 rental homes at the same time. We need that institutionally. Why are we taxing that entity when really we should be facilitating that in this market?
Yeah, absolutely. And we know that it's becoming harder and harder for mum and dad investors to prop up the rental market. We have seen quite a lot of rental stock being sold to owner occupiers, particularly over the last 2 years. And that's been a really big factor in how quickly our rental market has contracted.
Well, when you think about the bonds online stat that we spoke of a couple of weeks ago, we've lost 20,000 investors essentially over the last few years.
That's right. And so what we need to do is supplement that with another product, and we should be supplementing that with a product that thinks about the customer first. And that's what Build to Rent does. Equally, student accommodation is a really great opportunity to make sure that we're continuing to sustain our robust experience as a student city that we're building here in Perth, but in a way where students can be in a specialist accommodation that takes them out of family homes that might otherwise be share houses. It gives them an opportunity to still have that collaborative community experience.
When you think they're going into the city as well, there's a couple of big ones going into the city right now. That's people we need, foot traffic in that city, spending international money. If we don't have the accommodation ready to go for them, they're not coming to Perth. They're going to Canada, UK, Sydney. It's horse and cart here. We need to build these assets so that we can continue to be a strong education city.
Yeah, absolutely.
What other taxes are we looking at? You know, on this podcast, we hate stamp duty. What's going on in the stamp duty space in terms of what you're advocating for? Anything?
What we'd really like to see is, with the housing supply unit coming online, for there to be a comprehensive review of property taxes across the board. So we know that taxes and charges are somewhere between 20 to 40%, depending on the asset, depending on the suburb, etc. That's a significant additional cost on top of the base costs of a home. And that's a real barrier to affordability. But we also understand that these taxes and charges help us provide the infrastructure that keeps our state running. So what we'd really like to see is for state government to do a review of taxes that looks at where there might be greater opportunities to amortize tax over a longer period, or even reduce some of the thresholds so that we're seeing a higher rate of transaction that balances out stamp duty collection against a higher rate of transaction that makes it more malleable and easy for people to be making the right housing choices for themselves.
Has there been any research to show that if you reduce stamp duty, you would increase transactions, and that we know that if you increase transactions, you go through the roof on, again, the creation of new supply, GST on all of the services, mortgage brokers, real estate agents, settlement agents, building inspectors, all the people that are involved in a transaction? Surely if something has been done to show the government that, hey, let's say you halved stamp duty, you'd actually double your overall tax income by just increasing transaction volume.
I think that might have to be my next piece of research, Trent. Mm. We'll definitely put that into the books for next year. But I think what we do know is, we do know anecdotally that transactionary taxes are a massive barrier, particularly for downsizers. So it is a really good opportunity for the housing supply unit, and the property council are happy to support this work as well, to really look at where might there be some unnecessary transactionary barriers that we can reduce without really impacting the overall cost to government in terms of their total collection of tax, but spread it across the system a little bit more fairly and a little bit more reasonably, so that buyers aren't as impacted by transactionary taxes.
I think it's easy. Stop disincentivizing transactions and mobility and get that money back through the consummate incentivization of those transactions in other ways, if you have to. If it otherwise already isn't going to be made up for in simply allowing the free market to be maximized. That sounds like the summary there, right?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think the challenge always with a lot of these taxes is that they're pegged to thresholds, and that can be really challenging, particularly in a fast-moving market. One of the things that we've spoken about in our election platform is, particularly when you look at programs like Keystart, Keystart allowances or the Keystart eligibilities being pegged to price points has been somewhat challenging, because as the price points have moved, it's required legislative amendment to be able to still be able to have the same quantity of available dwellings accessible to the market. We know our wages aren't moving as fast as our price points are in our residential dwellings. So it's really about looking at where might there be better opportunities to look at pegging to market conditions or market medians, as opposed to trying to peg to a fixed threshold or a fixed dollar value, which doesn't really give the flexibility that's needed when the market is moving as quickly as it is here.
Okay, so first advocacy point, underwrite financing apartment buildings. Second, let's keep talking about how we optimize the tax mix to incentivize and facilitate more mobility in the housing market. What's number three?
Number three for us would really be looking at how we understand the cost of planning. So what we know is that there are two levels of government, or three levels of government across Australia, who influence planning policy when it comes to the delivery of new dwellings.
It's lovely, isn't it? Three hands in the pie.
What it does do is it creates a scenario where there's not necessarily clarity at all times around how one hand is impacting the outcome for the other. So we know that the state government have done a huge amount of work to try and reduce the planning barriers and the holding times on planning assessment. But then at the same time, we have seen a proliferation of other policies where the policy costs are fairly substantial when you look at them on the face. So a good example of this is where you look at something like a localised public art contribution.
It seems to have really become the new vogue, hasn't it? It started in a couple of councils, and then it really has just justified every other council to go, yeah, we like public art. Let's charge a developer 2% to put some weird piece of public art whether it's good or not, or whether it's needed or not.
The average Australian saves around $705 a month. So if we're adding a surcharge, which when you share that across a development adds $1,000 or $6,000 or $10,000 to the cost of a development, we're adding a substantial timeline of saving to that person against a rising housing market as well. So it really is, without intending to be, becoming a real barrier for people looking to enter into the housing market.
Do you think that there's a lack of understanding at the local level, especially, that when you add a tax, it isn't actually just chipping away at the greedy developer, it's actually adding to the cost of the end user? Do you think there's a real lack of connection and understanding that every time you add that dollar, it just gets passed through?
I think there's a lot of good intention that sits behind policy, with the idea being that building a community or supporting a design outcome or delivering a higher standard of product or whatever the case might be. But I think that we do need to really give some true thought to what the end user outcome is. So what we've proposed is that for any policy that relates to residential development or development, that there is a rigorous cost impact statement that is undertaken in advance so that we really truly understand the end user costs, not the developer costs. Because if we can understand the end user costs and they are triggering substantial price increases, then those policies should be given a higher degree of rigor before they are put out to market. So whether that's an approval by the WAPC or a ministerial approval being required at a local government level, at a state government level, whether that's a requirement for the policy to be taken to government with a comprehensive cost impact statement as a cover letter to the policy, those are two things that we would like to see. And the reason that we'd like to see that is because it's important that we're having conversations around public open space, public school contributions, public art contributions, and the like. But we need to be doing that in the context of understanding what that means for our housing affordability
and
in
the
WA
end user. It seems like the policy or the culture these days around state and local taxes is to continue to push what should be state government sponsored infrastructure costs onto the end user of the next house and land package, rather than it just being paid for by the mix of the 2.5 million of us in WA in the first place. Perfect example, Department of Education contribution that I was asked to pay in Canning Vale on a 33 lot land subdivision that we did, infill land subdivision. No one had built around there for 20 years, right? There was a primary school about 300 meters down the road. The Department of Education wanted me to pay $170,000 for 32 lots as a contribution to pay for schools that they'd already paid for 2 decades ago. So we're adding essentially $4,000 cost per lot that I need to pass on to the buyer. I then had to go to SAT in mediation, and they agreed to a price that was a fraction of that number, which then became a saving for the buyer. But you think about, if we didn't go through that argument, with which took time and money, with the Department of Education, we would have just been increasing the price of that block by another percent. What was that achieving? The schools are already there, already paid for. The money just goes straight into a government purse.
Yeah, look, we're at a real moment in time where housing really is essential to our economic growth. And so I think it triggers the opportunity for us to think differently about policy and how we're thinking about how we fund some of our core infrastructure. And this is a really good time, particularly with the housing supply unit coming online, for us to be thinking critically around how costs and charges that come from both state and local government really impact the feasibility of projects, but ultimately housing affordability and housing delivery in our state. And so we know that it's a body of work. We know that it's not an easy body of work, but it is one that we really need to give some due consideration to if we're going to tackle the housing crisis head on.
So the first thing that Minister Kerry did, I think in his like second week as Minister for Planning, was he put the draft POS policy in the bottom drawer. Is that gone away, or are we still talking about that as another possible cost to the end user in infill development in Perth?
I think Minister Kerry's been pretty unequivocal in his stance on the POS contributions, but we are seeing it a little bit in the survey strata space, which is something that's really problematic because townhouses are equally part of that housing diversity mix that we're needing to talk about. And a lot of the time we're talking about areas where previous POS contributions have already been paid because the existing policy has been around for such a long time that the likelihood was that when those suburbs were first subdivided, the POS was paid on that site already.
Yeah. The second you go to a second layer of subdivision to make it more dense, it's another opportunity for the state government to put their hand out.
Yeah, but I think we see that the POS is collected at a local government level and there has been some inconsistency in how it's being applied. We would really like to see POS not exist for survey strata or built strata development, and we're continuing to work with the state government on this.
Perfect example. We managed two 4-lot subdivisions next to each other in St. James, so City of Canning. The ingenuity of this development was that we were sharing a common driveway through reciprocal easements, saving space, minimizing heat island effect. The WAPC wanted to enforce a POS contribution on all 8 lots on both developments next to each other, which would have been tens of thousands of dollars if we went down the survey strata route, because that's what they controlled the clearance of. The City of Canning, to their credit, came and said, well, look, if you just do it built strata, we have no need for that money. Two levels of government with different policies, one pragmatic, one following policy. And you have to ask, what was that achieving?
Yeah, that's right. And certainly for apartment projects, we have seen that the requirement for POS has moved away. But for townhouses and for other forms of medium density, we are still seeing that there is some requests coming through. And I think the sooner we can nib that in the butt, the better for housing supply.
There's not a place in Perth I've seen POS contributions get used to buy back houses by the local government and turn them into extra parks. Not a place. So where is that money going? It's not going on gold plating swing sets, and it shouldn't either. The whole point of urban infill is that we're sharing existing facilities, existing roads, existing primary schools, existing police stations, and existing parks. That's my understanding of how it should be working. That's my ideological argument about why at no point should extra costs of public open space contribution be passed on to people who are happy to share in urban infill environments.
Yeah, it's also really challenging when we look at some of the public open space policies that exist when they're looked at on a really localized local government level, because what they don't take into account quite often is public open space that sits on the boundary on the other side of a local government boundary.
Or regional POS.
That's exactly right. I know that there is an appetite for this issue to be looked at more closely, and we're continuing to work with the state government on it.
Okay, so that's three big hitter policies there, two of them being really taxes and other charges. So we're really focusing on reducing the cost that's being passed on to the end user as prices continue to rise from market dynamics. What about number four?
Look, I think probably it's around how do we maximise on our workforce, our skilled workforce, and bring in the skills we need to help continue to grow WA. So one of the challenges that we've seen in recent years is that over the last 20 years, I think it's only around 1.5 or 1.8% of all migrants who have moved to Australia have identified as being in the construction
workplace. Isn't that astonishing? Especially in the last few years where it's obvious to everyone those are the people we need.
Yeah, it's a really small number. And so what we need to do is really think about two things. It's how do we build our workforce and our workforce capacity? And then secondly, how do we incentivize people to come to WA if they are a skilled tradesperson looking for a really robust market to play in? And we know that whilst housing is an issue across Australia, we have seen some of the infrastructure projects turning down in some other states. And so now is a really great time to build a life in WA. One of the ideas that we've put forward is the idea of introducing a payroll tax concession for companies that relocate workers from the East Coast who stay in WA for at least 2 years.
Because this is a state tax, payroll tax.
That's right. All of the recommendations in the election platform relate to things that the state government can do, because we are heading towards our state government election next year. And that will coincide as well with a federal government election too. So I think it's a really good opportunity for both the state and the federal government to be having some robust conversations around how do we maximise our workforce? How do we make sure we're bringing in the right skills at the right time? And then also, how do we keep people in those skills and trade and make it a really robust industry?
Isn't it ironic, really, that the problem of housing supply is being exacerbated by the high levels of immigration we have? But the solution is also in immigration. We don't have the people who are, you and I aren't picking up trowels and paintbrushes. We don't have the people in our state that can solve this problem, or we don't have enough of them. The solution is we need to bring them in from overseas or the East Coast. But the problem has been that we're certainly bringing people in, just not the right type of people to solve this problem.
Yeah, and look, we have been really strategic about migration in the past. So during COVID, we really put a focus on bringing healthcare workers into the state. We've had a firm focus in recent years as well around bringing police into WA. This is a really great opportunity for us to look at where are there additional incentives for us to bring construction and tradespeople into Western Australia. One of the ideas that we proposed is for the state government to consider the opportunity to look at trade ticketing people using our trade and migration offices across the world to be able to pre-accredit tradies before they come into Australia. So when they're coming into Western Australia, they've already got their ticket to work in construction, or they've already got their electrician's certificate. They can start day one. And that means we're not losing people to other jobs that don't require a ticket because they need to be earning money straight away. The other thing that we're looking at is where are there opportunities for us to build differently and really invest in changing the way that we build in WA so that it can be a little bit... Yeah, exactly. So we know that on the East Coast, for example, we've seen some modular apartment projects that have gone up really quickly. But that at the moment in WA is quite an expensive exercise because all of the materials need to come from the East Coast.
Isn't that strange? Like, we have the iron ore. We make the iron ore. We should be able to get the steel straight back from China. Why is it going to Sydney? What specific equipment here don't we have?
So it's really the research and development into creating that modular asset in state. I think it's a really good opportunity for us to look, as we're building our new industries, at state government investment in R&D into modular as being a really serious opportunity for us.
So is it the IP we're talking about here, the how we do it rather than the imported goods that would come from somewhere anyway?
I think it's both. I think it's really about how do we build the capacity within that prefab space, but then also building the industry, a prefabricated industry here in WA, which will really substantially reduce the costs associated with building modular. And we know there's a lot of interest and appetite from the development community to do things differently. During COVID, we saw a big move away from the old double brick favourite of WA into steel frames and wooden timber frames. Exactly.
This is the issue. We're a victim of our own luck in WA in that for the most part over our history, which is where the skills and IP are built, double brick has been the cheapest way to build because we have big piles of clay out on the hills ready to go. And for the most part, steel and timber have been exorbitantly more expensive than that. It was only when it got to a point where the bricklayers started charging through the nose over COVID that you start to go, oh, maybe steel and timber are actually parity now. Let's look at that because it will be quicker. And then the price of steel and timber went through the roof with the Ukraine war and other issues. And as the price of bricklayers and bricks start to come down a little bit again, it actually goes back to the issue of how do we affordably stack this up against double brick?
I mean, I think it's the old adage, right? If we always do what we've always done, we'll always get what we've always got. Mm. So this is a really good opportunity for us to think differently about how we deliver housing, but it won't be industry-led holistically. There does need to be that backing from government to really get these new industries off the ground, and this is a really brilliant new industry for us to look at investing in.
So if we tie it together, are you suggesting essentially that John Kerry needs to continue building his social housing apartment buildings, and maybe they should be steel frame prefab buildings to build that competency from that in the first place?
Yeah, and they should be built here. So that could be a really good solution for us.
And that's five big ideas. To wrap this up, you said it was bipartisan in terms of the ideas before. Are you getting the same positive feedback from both sides of Parliament House?
I think every political stakeholder that we talk to really appreciates the fact that we need to be doing quite a lot when it comes to the property market and how we can best support the property market across WA. We know that the linchpin to our economic productivity and success over the long term is going to be our capability to house a growing population. And so this really is a central issue as we head towards 2025. There's been a lot of really good work done to position WA as an economic epicenter on the doorstep of Asia with direct international flights coming to and from. We're in a really good spot to grow. Now it's really just about how can we all come together and think about delivering the sort of infrastructure, housing and new industries that are going to take WA into this next life.
I agree with you. I think that this election is going to be all about housing supply, about housing prices and getting a roof over people's heads. And it will be the party that has the most agreeable ideas on how we solve this problem that no one seems to be able to solve right now, that will be the one that relatively wins this election. It will come down to who ascribes to the best ideas. And obviously, the PCA has brought to the table very strong and smart ideas and very achievable ideas that can be a part of the mix. Not the whole mix, but a big part of the mix to fixing this problem in WA.
Yeah, that's right. And look, there's 36 recommendations in this report. So
we don't have an episode for that, mate. Sorry.
Fairly comprehensive. We're really optimistic about Western Australia, and we're really optimistic about the conversations that we're having to help move West Australia into this next stage. And so combined with some of these ideas and also a general community push towards saying YIMBY, let's say, I think we'll be in a pretty good trajectory.
Team WA, I reckon.
Team WA.
Thanks, Emily.
Thanks, Trent.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Perth Property Show. If you've only just joined the conversation, you can catch up by heading over to our website, perthpropertyshow.com.au, subscribing to the podcast, or joining our Facebook page. Don't forget to tune in next Monday at 7 a.m. for more expert insights, local analysis, and suburb spotlights. Happy hunting!